This is Jim Inkster. Coming next on Talk Louisiana, we will visit with Sydney Coffey of America's Wetland Foundation. She has an update on her organization's effort to thwart coastal erosion in our community. Big announcement yesterday, and certainly this is one of the major issues facing the state of Louisiana. Also on the show, Bo Danton of the Serenity Center on challenges involving opioid addiction. Opioid addiction now takes more lives than homicides and car wrecks in the United States, and it is a huge problem in our state and in this area. And we'll visit with singer Ivan Griffin, bass baritone of renown from Southern University, who's making quite an impression around the globe. We'll talk with him. He's in town, back in his homeland. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and thank you for making our Spring Member Fest successful. I'm glad you're listening, and your number is 877-217-5757 or 297-5633. You can email us talk@talklouisiana.org. We begin with Sydney Coffey, Senior Advisor to America's Wetland Foundation, formerly the head of the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority, and she's been involved in trying to thwart coastal erosion in our state for about two decades, and this is a continuing problem. We've talked about it many times on this show, and I'm sure this is something generations to come will be addressing, as Louisiana is losing about a football field less than every hour of the day of every day of the year. So the problem is not going away, and yesterday America's Wetland Foundation had an announcement, and tell us what happened on Thursday, Sydney.
Well, we're very excited about this, Jim. You know, America's Wetland has long been a voice on coastal issues. We've been an advocate for the most part, trying to bring people together, all the users of the coast, together to find solutions and move forward. And now we've sort of gone to a different level. We're actually putting real projects in the ground. And we announced yesterday two of those projects down in Terrebonne Parish that we're very excited about. We think they're great projects. And we're partnering with RES, that's Resource Environmental Solutions. And they're a homegrown company that's been growing plants specifically for coastal restoration for decades now. And the sponsor of the project is an energy company that does business on our coast called BHP. It's headquartered in Houston, and it's an Australian company. They have a very strong social responsibility mission, and they see this as part of their mission, bolstering communities through environmental work where their own employees live.
Now, there are some who, of course, view the oil and gas industry as a culprit, as an enemy in the fight against coastal erosion. You're partnering with them. Is that something that is palatable?
Well, that's why we were created over 16, almost 17 years ago, because we wanted very definitely, specifically, to bring industry to the table, along with fisheries and transportation and environmental groups and government agencies. Any user of the coast has to be a part of the solution. They have to be. And we have worked very, very hard for the last, especially 5 years, to get the public sector involved in actually doing projects, working with NGOs, and with the state itself in moving forward on projects we can build that are practical, that also protect their assets, which makes sense.
Now, Val Marmillion, we've had him on many times. He's he's the head honcho with America's Wetland Foundation.
Right.
His involvement in this and his odyssey in getting to this point is an interesting one.
It is. He actually worked for with John Brough when he created the Brough Act, we call it, which is the QIPRA program, which first started trying to address coastal erosion through projects that were headed mainly by federal agencies, and the state worked with them very closely.
What is the goal of these projects in Terrebonne Parish?
Well, there are two projects. One is in Pointe aux Chenes, and it builds on marsh restoration project that's already in place. This adds a ton of acreage to it. And expands what's already been done there. So that's good. Anytime we can expand on existing projects, it's great. The other one I'm very excited about, it's at Bayou Terrebonne, and it's a terracing project, but they're doing these very, planting very hardy cypress trees on top of the ridges, which is something not always done. And they've developed techniques through the years for the plants and the cypress trees that hardens them and allows them to be much more saltwater tolerant, which is a very important piece of the puzzle where we have these projects. And the Bayou Terrebonne project is one that actually helps protect an existing structure, that protection structure that the people tax themselves for and have built. Because you can't just have a structure and forget about the wetlands that actually protect the protection. So that's a really good project.
Is there a magic bullet to this? It seems that we keep talking about it, and the issue is permeating, and we continue to lose coastline.
I know we do. And no, there is no magic bullet. I wish there was. We would have used that magic bullet a long time ago.
Well, sometimes the magic bullet is quite expensive. And
it's very expensive.
I think that's where the issue is, is the country, the United States of America, and industry. Are these entities willing to pay the cost?
Well, as far as the federal government, it hasn't been so far. Definitely hasn't been. And so that's why, you know, unfortunately with the BP spill, we had to have a tragedy that actually gave us the money to jumpstart the state's master plan. The state's master plan is unto itself the best, most comprehensive plan of any ecosystem restoration in America, for sure. And the state's plan is going to do a lot to get us where we need to be to sustain this coast. We do not have enough money to make that happen. That's why we felt these little projects that we're trying to do are time savers. They're time buyers, if you will. We try to look at this in a very generational way. Mm-hmm. We can't just look 5 years from now. What America's Wetland has tried to do with our partners is take this generational look. What can we do to buy time to hold the line on some of the saltwater intrusion while those large state projects come online? Because these communities that are looking, some of them are looking at not being here for the long haul. 20 years makes a difference. 15 years makes a difference when you're trying to make decisions about how you're going to sustain businesses, communities, livelihoods, homes. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're moving into this arena at this level. It's not the giant projects. It's the $4 to $10 million projects.
Well, it's something that has to have a collective consciousness to succeed, and we know we have a problem. Are local officials fully engaged on this?
They really are. They're very excited about it. This is such a great way for the private sector, the local communities, the local officials who are responsible for what happens on their coast, and the state to come together with NGOs and make things like this happen, do some of these projects that can actually hold the line.
If we don't do anything, how quickly are we going to have what amounts to oceanfront? Or we have a water property right here in Baton Rouge if we don't act soon. How quickly would that happen?
You know, Baton Rouge already has its own set of problems, which we found out, and all these inland communities, because it's all a connected piece. You know, for some of the ones more on the coast, you're looking at, in some cases, less than 20 years.
All right. Dan Collins calling here in Baton Rouge. Dan, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Good morning. Sydney, what are y'all doing to address the possible conflicts with the oil and gas industry that directly correlates to the project and exploration of oil and gas? I'm asking this question as a lifelong citizen of the state of Louisiana and a whistleblower that actually won a successful jury verdict of blowing the whistle on a water quality project where there were 7 wells drilled at the direct end of a dredge.
He's talking about Bayou Postillion, and we've featured this on the show, and there are those that believe that industry quite often takes advantage of the environment and does what it wants to do, ultimately, because of its power and might in our state. Is that an acceptable view of what's going on and what's being done to make sure those kinds of things don't happen again?
Well, I wish I could say that America's Wetland, a regional foundation, could wave a magic wand and cure all the ills out there. We cannot. What we chose to do at the very beginning and are still doing is finding practical pathways to get public sector involvement, be it an oil an oil company, be it Entergy, who is one mm-hmm. of our big sponsors, and work with us, you know, all the time on projects, be it national foundations that deal in these things. We've gotten funding from the Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which is playing a big role right now in restoration and moving the BP
money. So it's not just industry.
No, it's not just industry.
And you, as mentioned, are the former head of the Coastal Protection Restoration Authority.
Right.
So you've been doing this a long time, and I know you fervently believe in what you're doing and with whom you're doing it, the America's Wetland Foundation. For those who'd like more information about your organization, what's the best way to find out more about the America's Wetland Foundation?
Just go to our website, America's, with an S, Wetland Foundation, just americaswetland.com. We have all kinds of information there.
Well, thank you, Sydney Coffey, and appreciate your commitment to the environment and to the coast.
Thank you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
And we'll return with Bo Danton of the Serenity Center on opioid addiction and more after this time out on WRKF. Two, one. This is Jim Inkster, and we're joined now by Bo Danton, and he is with the Serenity Center, and this is an entity that is an underwriter for WRKF, but certainly a major component in our community. Bo deals with professionals that provide chemical dependency treatment, and this is a place that offers care for male and female adults 18 years and older who are faced with challenges of alcoholism and drug dependencies. And Bo, this is a time when we're hearing much about opioid addiction, but there is certainly a major challenge ongoing, not only in this community, but all over the country. What's going on?
Yeah, well, first, Jim, thanks for having me. It is a major problem, to say the least, going on throughout our country, especially our state and even at the micro level at our city level. People are dying. People are dying in record numbers of opioid addiction and all substance addiction across the board. So it's something that, as a clinician, we're seeing more and more and more of, where, just for instance, in 2012 in Baton Rouge, we had 5 deaths from opioid overdose, and in 2016 we had 89. So
switch from 5 to 89 in 4 years.
Yeah, it's like a 750% increase.
Yeah, and this is an issue that is ongoing, and one of the challenges is that people who try to beat the addiction, if they go back to opioid use, it's particularly lethal at that point.
Absolutely. Going to a detox is great. That's the first step to trying to get clean. You have to get off the substance. You have to clean your brain out, you know, get sober. The problem is, though, is that when they don't get proper treatment, or they don't get treatment at all, and they just try and white-knuckle it or fix it themselves, generally that doesn't work, just because of how pervasive and serious addiction is. And they go back using about the same amount that they were before, and their body just doesn't have the tolerance that it did. So it ends up killing them.
Well, we often hear about the 12-step process.
Mm-hmm.
Is that an age-old treatment that still works, or is it something that has to be tweaked as we move along?
Well, you know, I think that the core of it is still absolutely relevant. You have to surrender your addiction to something bigger than yourself. You can no longer serve yourself. You can no longer just be, can be just a black hole of consuming everything around you, because that's what addiction is. You have to, you know, give that up, and you have to serve, you know, my belief is you have to serve God. You have to serve something bigger than yourself and find that purpose that isn't selfish, it's selfless. You know, the core of that not only is fixing your life and connecting with yourself again, connecting with God, is connecting with other people. And connecting with other people is another key. It's passing along what you've been given so that you find your purpose and that you see that your life has meaning.
We're visiting with Bo Danton of the Serenity Center of Louisiana, based here in Baton Rouge. Bo graduated with a bachelor's in psychology from Southeastern in 2008, then earned his master's in marriage and family therapy and counseling from Reformed Theological Seminary in 2010. What kind of training is essential for people who are dealing with addicts, dealing with people who have these challenges?
Yeah, well, I think that absolutely you have to have a background in psychology. You have to have a background in, you know, why people do what they do. The practical experience of working with addicts is second to none. I mean, you have to get in there and have, you know, years of experience of working with addiction, working with addicts' families, seeing how pervasive it is, as far as how it affects everyone in that, in their system. I mean, more than anything, you have to care. You know, you know, at our center, we have people that go through like a CIT process that haven't graduated college and they're learning how to be counselors and they have practical experience. A lot of them, you know, have been addicts themselves and they're in recovery. And then you have people, you know, that have graduate, you know, level training, and they all work together and they mix well because they have different perspectives and they have,
Well, these centers like yours, quite often they offer something called, and you do it as well, the residential treatment program. What is that, a month-long stay? Is that basically how that works? What can you accomplish in a month?
Yeah, so generally a month is a month in treatment is all about laying a foundation. So just like I spoke before about reconnecting with yourself, reestablishing that connection with yourself, with God, and with other people, learning how to be sober in the sense of surrendering yourself back over to God, or we say a power greater than yourself, getting clean and getting sober off that substance, getting the adequate mental health care is incredibly important. So counseling, because, you know, 2/3 of people that struggle with substance abuse have underlying mental health problems. And if you don't address those, then generally you're going to go back to using. So we address that through counseling, medication if needed. So there's that. So we do we do intensive therapy. We do education about what substances and what addiction is and why the person's addicted and why their efforts in the past haven't worked. So we do that. It's a month-long process. We also educate the families through family therapy.
What family therapy? Some people have more family than others, and some people have more supportive families than others. But how important is it to have people close to the person who's fighting dependency?
Yeah, well, statistically, their chances of staying sober if their family is involved and supportive greatly increases. When the family learns boundaries, when they learn how not to enable but to still love them and support them, their chance of staying sober greatly increases.
Do you see this spiraling problem we're having with opioid addiction turning around? It seems like every year is worse than the preceding one. More people are dying from this than car wrecks and homicides now in our country. It's a largely uncovered story. There is attention, but probably not nearly as much as there should be. Where are we going with this?
Well, I can't say. I think that it's definitely something that's incredibly alarming. I think that the more people that get educated about it, the better. You know, you asked me earlier about the age-old, you know, 12 steps, and does that work? Yeah, it works. there's also a new component too, and that's the neuroscience behind addiction. Mm-hmm. When people learn why they're addicted, why addiction is really so evil, it's so against how we're built as human beings, how it hijacks your survival system in your brain to actually kill you. I mean, the more people are educated about what it is, about what they're putting in their bodies, why they're prescribed what they're prescribed, you know, I think the better. Will it turn around? You know, I truly hope that it will.
I would think with this kind of addiction that it's not only important to have qualified therapists on hand, but medical people as well. This mm-hmm. has a component that goes way beyond just providing counseling. You really need to know the medical aspects of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do in that regard?
Yeah, well, that's pretty broad. You know, I'm not a doctor, so I can't necessarily say, what the medical community needs to do about it. But I think that having non-narcotic prescriptions to deal with some of the classic forms of why people become addicted, such as alternatives to opioids, alternatives to opioid medicine is what I'm saying, alternatives to benzodiazepine addictions, alternatives to like ADHD medicine that can become addicted. You know, I think that the more the medical community tries to find alternatives to giving addicted substances, the better.
Well, we commend you for your work at the Serenity Center. And as mentioned, the center is an underwriter for WRKF, but you're doing important work, and best of luck. I think our community and the world at large needs more places like this to find some answers to these searing questions that are ongoing, particularly with opioid addiction. Thank you, Bo Dan.
Thanks, sir. You bet.
This is Jim Engster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. If you're dialing locally, it's 297-5633, and our email is talk@talklouisiana.org. We have a gentleman in studio who has a big voice, Ivan Griffin, bass baritone from Southern University. He has a new CD, a Louisiana lad who's done well, and it is a pleasure to share the microphone with you, Ivan Griffin.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, it's certainly been quite a voyage for you since you left Southern. You performed in a lot of places, haven't you?
Indeed, I have, yes.
International opera star.
Mm-hmm.
When did you develop this affinity for the work you do?
Very interesting. I was a young boy, and I remember hearing, I've sung most of my life. I grew up in the church in Slidell and doing what I do. And at an early age, I remember hearing an opera on television, seeing an opera, and I just took to it. I was captivated by it. And I remember saying, I can do that. And then from that point on, that kind of started me on my path toward an interest in singing opera. And then I matriculated at Southern University, found a voice teacher there who really took an interest in me, recruited me, went there, studied, and then went from there on to graduate school, Eastman School of Music, studied there. And then afterwards, I began to do regional opera auditions and performances and what have you. And then the career just began to grow from that point.
Not everybody has your voice. So when you said, I can do that, you must have known you had the pipes that could pull this off.
Yes. Yeah. My mom said that, leave it to mothers. My mother said that I was singing in the crib. Believe that if you will. But who am I to dispute that? But I was singing at a very young age, and I grew up in a musical family. My brother was a pianist. My mother was a pianist. And I sang.
Grew up in New Orleans.
I was born in New Orleans, but I grew up in Slidell.
Well,
that's my hometown.
Not too far away.
Right.
But I didn't know Slidell had that kind of a music heritage, but enough that you got exposed at an early age.
Oh, absolutely. Mama and Daddy made sure that we had exposure to the arts in general, all kinds mm-hmm. of music, to the symphony, to ballet, that we would go to the ballet and see that. And, of course, growing up in the church. So we had a well-rounded education, musical education, if you will, and began taking piano lessons at the age of four.
for.
Mm-hmm.
Was that willing or was that forced upon you?
Well, it was, I don't know if it was forced, but at 4 years old, how much of a choice do you have? You know, it's what she did. And I imagine we would tinker around with the piano at home, and she saw the interest. And the piano teacher lived next door to us. It was a neighbor.
Well, we're visiting with Ivan Griffin, Southern University and New Orleans native, grew up in Slidell. His latest CD is Finding My Way Back to Me, and it includes music composed by none other than Valerian Smith, mm-hmm. who's kind of a legend in these parts.
Yes.
The late Valerian Smith.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the father of Len Whitfield.
Indeed.
So
yes.
How much of an impact did he have on you?
Oh, wow. It was a great impact. I met Valerian when I was a student at Southern, and he would come over to the university to rehearse. He had the Baton Rouge Community Chorus, I believe it was, mm-hmm. at the time. And they would come over to the university and rehearse, and I was introduced to him at that point as an undergrad, and I began to sing with that chorus. And then I got involved in some of his other productions. And he was a great influence because he gave me an additional platform in which to express my gifts. And I embraced that wholeheartedly. And he taught me about commitment, if you will. And not that I didn't understand it when I left home, but, you know, I was young. Mm-hmm. And you're young, you're a little flighty sometimes. And sometimes I would say, okay, Valerian, I'm going to do such and such a thing. And then I would try to back out of it at the last moment, right? Just because something else struck my fancy. So how he influenced me was he just said these words. He said, you know, when you make a commitment to people, they're relying on you. And that just resonated with me. And at that point, I was like, got it.
Yeah. You've performed all over the world, haven't you?
I have indeed. I've performed in Europe. I've been in Belgium and France and Holland and Spain. I've been in Mexico. I've performed in South Africa. So I've been quite a few places.
Any favorites along the way?
I loved France. Yes, there's just something about France that resonates with me. Yeah, that was my favorite.
Well,
place.
In his latest work, Ivan is collaborating with a gentleman, Thomas Dawson, mm-hmm. who had quite an association with a major pop group, the Commodores.
Indeed.
So he was rubbing shoulders with Lionel Richie, and now it's Ivan Griffin. How was that experience working with him?
Oh, it's like a reunion. Thomas and I were at Southern at the same time, and that's where we met. Then we went our separate ways, you know, after graduation. And I hadn't seen Thomas in a long time. And we were reconnected. So I didn't know what he was doing. We'd lost track of each other. And we were reconnected when I was in Colorado Springs, Colorado, doing a concert there. And we began to, he surprised me. He heard I was coming to do a concert, and he surprised me. So that was a wonderful reunion. An absolutely wonderful reunion being there, and it has been a joy. From the time we got back together, we have remained in touch, and have this collaboration with him has been an absolute, absolute pleasure. It's been very comfortable.
877-217-5757 is your number, and we have a few more minutes with Ivan Griffin, an incomparable singer, opera star, internationally known, from Southern University, who's back in his homeland, at least where he went to college. And he also has a new CD, Finding My Way Back to Me, with original music composed by Valerian Smith. Ali Baltazar, let's give a listen to Ivan Griffin and some of his contemporary work.
Beyond the doubt, the fear, the terrible unrest, he calls me forth triumphantly and strengthened by God's grace. I'm alive again, I'm alive in this place. I'll sing it till I'm gone, now that I know myself. Of you.
smile as I cry. Cry
on a hill far away, stood an old rugged cross, the emblem of suffering and shame.
Pretty good stuff.
Thank you. Thank you. All scored by Thomas.
All by Thomas, yes. Who is still with the Commodores and took time out from his schedule to be involved in this project.
Indeed.
And you must have met each other when you were, what, teenagers?
We were. Yes, yes. Yeah. We were younger at Southern. And
Southern University has always been known for its music, particularly its marching band, but some huge talents have come through there.
Absolutely. Southern had a really dynamic music program, and it was really, as quiet as it was kept, the vocal program was actually quite fine, quite fine.
Who were some of your mentors?
My biggest mentor at Southern, I will say, was Dr. Aldrich Adkins. Dr. Adkins was chair of the department of the Division of Music, it was called at that particular time. And he recruited me to come to Southern. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, he came to a program that my brother and I did at my home church in Slidell. I didn't know him. He was invited by the alumni president of Southern in Slidell. He came, he liked what he heard, and there on the spot, right after the concert, in front of the congregation or the audience, he offered me a full ride to Southern.
Wow.
And I was a junior going into my senior year, plus
and where did you go
free
to high school?
Voice
where did
lessons.
You go to high school?
Salmon High School in Slidell.
Yeah.
And
right.
I would come to Baton Rouge and take voice lessons.
Where Alan Risher went to high school.
You know Alan, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Quite a quarterback in his day.
Yes,
at LSU.
Indeed. Yes.
But Slidell has produced quite a voice in Ivan Griffin. And what do you do to maintain it?
Practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Practice. There's a lot of practice. I still take coachings. I still have vocal coachings with a person here in Baton Rouge, Lorraine Sims, over at LSU. I visit with Lorraine periodically, and she makes sure that things stay in check for me. And just keeping the voice aligned and working. Yeah.
In the old days, some of these great singers, as we know, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, and some opera stars, they smoked. You don't do that.
Mm,
do you?
No.
Don't take care of your voice when you do that.
No.
Resonance doesn't come from smoking.
No, not at all.
No. But you knew you had it at an early age, and it's apparent that you still have it. And this man is a substantial talent and one that we should treasure as we celebrate Louisiana music with Festival International this weekend in Lafayette and the Jazz Fest in New Orleans. And you have performed there in the past.
I have. Yes, yes.
Well, we wish you well, and congratulations on your continuing success and your new CD, Ivan Griffin, Finding My Way Back to Me, with original music composed by Valerian Smith. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Jim, thank you for having me.
Thank you, Ivan. And we'll return with more Talk Louisiana after this pause on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar and Becca Dill are producing, and your number is 877-217-5757. Jazz Fest opening in New Orleans. We just heard a big voice in Ivan Griffin, who is one of those Louisiana treasures. We've talked with Philip Manuel many times on this show. He usually performs at the Jazz Fest, and he has a voice that rivals anybody in the world. And Ivan, of course, is an opera star with a spectacular sound. The Jazz Fest opened in 1970, so this is year number 49th Jazz Fest. And the original performers included Duke Ellington, Mahalia Jackson, Fats Domino, The Meters, Pete Fountain, and Al Hurt. And Al Hurt, Alois Maxwell Hurt, died on this date in 1999, 19 years ago. Al Hurt was 76 years old, and what a spectacular talent he was. A true legend with the big horn, the big man, Jumbo, from New Orleans. And for those who remember, and for those who have never heard Al Hurt, here's how he sounded in his prime. Al Hurt. That was his biggest hit. He had more than a few. A frequent performer, as we know, on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, as was Pete Fountain, who I think made more appearances than anybody in the history of that program. And together they dominated Bourbon Street for many years, a few yards away from each other. Chris Owens is still there. She is about to celebrate her 85th birthday and still dancing and singing on Bourbon Street. But Al Hurt, born, by the way, November 7th, 1922, exactly 20 years to the date before a Louisiana singing legend from Baton Rouge, Johnny Ramostella, better known as Johnny Rivers. So Johnny Rivers, who is still doing his thing, is now, unbelievably, Johnny Rivers is 75 years old. Can that be true? The man who hit top of the charts in 1966 with Poor Side of Town is 75 years old, the pride of Baton Rouge High? Yes, he is. That means Al Hurt, if he were alive today, would be 95 years old. Yesterday, by the way, was the birth date of former LSU athletic director, the late, great Joe Dean, who led the Tiger athletic program from 1987 to 2001. He was also a major basketball star in Tiger Town and, of course, became best known as a commentator of college basketball with his patented string music. Joe Dean died a few years ago, but he was born on this date in 1930 in Indiana. He used to go to the Kentucky Derby every year. He grew up right across the Ohio River from Louisville, and Joe Dean was a man who came out of private industry to become the athletic director at LSU. He had tried once before unsuccessfully in 1978 when Jay Darden was a student member of the board and tried valiantly to get Joe Dean hired, and the board of supervisors decided to go with Paul Dietzel. Well, 9 years later, he was hired in the year of 1987. He was 56 years old, and he came to LSU. And Allie, let's give a listen to what Joe Dean said when he became the athletic director at Louisiana State University.
We're going to run a quality program that's built on honesty and integrity, and it's just going to happen. That's all there is to it. You don't have to cheat in big-time athletics to win. A lot of people around the country sometimes laugh at that, but it can be done the right way.
Well, Joe Dean won more championships as AD than any other athletic director in the history of the school, primarily because of the wild success of the track and field program, women's track and field, but of course, he was around when Skip Bertman won all of his titles as baseball coach, and then ultimately Bertman succeeded Joe Dean, who was criticized for hiring one Hudson Curley Holman to lead the LSU football Tigers in the year of 1990 after Mike Archer failed as head coach with two losing seasons. Curley Holman came in and had four straight losing seasons, so that was six in a row for LSU. Dean hired Jerry DiNardo, who had three good seasons, then two bad ones, and then boom, it was Joe Dean, who through Sean Toohey found a guy from Michigan State who was a bit restless, 48-year-old Nick Lou Saban, to lead the Fighting Tigers in the year of 1999. Saban left East Lansing to become head coach at LSU, and within 4 years he had the Tigers as national champions, and then we know what happened. He left to go to Miami in the pros, and didn't do particularly well there, 15 and 17 in 2 years, and And then Nick Saban became head coach at Alabama, where he has won 5 national championships. So that's 6 of them for Nick Saban, who was hired at LSU by Robert Joe Dean, who was quite a character, and we miss him. Really a fascinating guy to talk to. Speaking of LSU, the Reveille today has a major front page story, Save Student Newsrooms. The same entity, the Student Government Association, which a few years ago approved an $85 million recreation center at LSU, is now recommending cuts to student media. The legislation proposes fees for the Gumbo Yearbook be cut entirely, and the remaining fees for the Daily Reveille, Tiger TV, and KLSU consolidated into one fee. The legislation also recommends that Legacy Magazine be discontinued, and fees that would have gone toward it be reallocated to the remaining student media outlets. Additionally, part-time students would pay a $2 per credit hour if the student body votes in favor and the referendum passes in the fall. But much of the student fees have gone to that rec center, which is quite magnificent right there by Sorority Row. But it looks like the Student Government Association does not have an affinity for the media on campus. And the Reveille, as we know, has gone to one day a week, and it is losing more money now in one day a week than it did when it was printing 4 days a week. So maybe it's time for the Reveille to ramp up and start printing more issues and being more visible on campus, because, after all, it is called the Daily Reveille. If you picked up your Baton Rouge Advocate today, the front page story above the Bill Cosby conviction on sexual assault is about none other than Tom Shedler, the Secretary of State of Louisiana, who has stayed in office despite allegations of sexual misconduct. A former employee has accused him of acting inappropriately and badgering and harassing her while she was employed by him, and she is still part of the staff at the Secretary of State's office. And Tom Shedler has been in office for 2 terms. He was reelected by a pretty good margin in 2015 in a tough race against Chris Tyson. But today there are actual emails that are on the front page, which are not very flattering for Tom Shedler. And now none other than John Neely Kennedy, the junior U.S. Senator for Louisiana and prospective candidate for governor and fellow Republican, the headline that he has sent through his press office, Senator Kennedy calls for Secretary of State Shedler to resign. Here's the quote from John Kennedy. Secretary Shedler has claimed the truth about the sexual harassment allegations against him by his employee can be found somewhere in the middle. The emails published today tell a different story. They show that he crossed the line and abused his position. It saddens me to say this, but Tom needs to resign. There is no place in Louisiana for sexual harassment in the workplace. That is from Senator John Kennedy. Now, Bill Cassidy, to my knowledge, has not commented on this, the senior United States Senator from Louisiana. But Tom Shedler, who has a little more than, well, about a year and a half remaining in his term, he would leave office in January of 2020. He has said he would like to finish out his term, that he will not seek re-election, and that the truth is somewhere in the middle. And today, the Advocate, through a public records request, has many of the emails. Some of the information was redacted, but the Advocate, in a story by Jim Mustian, very good reporter, he got the originals. And Tom Shedler obviously was quite familiar with this lady, who's been identified as Dawn Ross, and he was continuing his pursuit of her on company time, meaning state time in this case, using his state email account, which I'm sure he regrets doing. But nonetheless, there are those who are calling for his resignation, including the governor of Louisiana, who was out in front on this, John Bel Edwards. He's a Democrat, and some thought it's a lot easier for him to ask for the resignation of a Republican than it would be for another Republican. But John Kennedy, who may very well be the opponent of John Bel Edwards in next year's governor's election, today is also requesting the resignation, or demanding it, of Tom Shedler, Secretary of State. But this is the same John Kennedy who backed fervently David Vitter when he was exposed as a patron of prostitutes, and it was John Kennedy who was at David Vitter's election night headquarters in 2015 when he lost the governor's election to one John Bel Edwards. But it should be a fascinating race if it happens, and it may, between John Kennedy and John Bel Edwards, and the race is getting close, October of next year. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.